Okay, everybody, welcome back to another Boiling Frogs Post Roundtable. I am Pierce Redman, and joining us today are two of my favorite contributors to BoilingFrogsPost.com, Christoph Gehrman and James Corbett. Well, Christoph and James, how are you guys?
I'm doing pretty good, but it's been a long time since I've contributed to BFP, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, I mean, all the more reason to have you on right now. And we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic and something that I'm sure the BFP community is, keeping track of. And it's something that has been discussed before on a roundtable. But we're going to be talking mainly about the ISIS and the sort of evolution, where it is going lately right now. The past few months, there have been quite a lot of developments, both in the region, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, but also within the internal politics of Al-Qaeda. And we're going to be kind of discussing what is happening to Al-Qaeda right now and how ISIS is going to fill that void. So it might be something that you think, I know what's going on, but we're going to be kind of taking a different angle with some of this. And we're going to start with a recent article that I would definitely encourage all of the BFP community to go out and read, and that is an article by Nafiz Ahmed. He was writing on his new website, but it's also available on like Middle East Eye and a few other sites have carried it as well. But in it, he was elaborating on a recent FOIA request that Judicial Watch finally got. Judicial Watch, for anyone that doesn't know, is a conservative watchdog group. And, even if your politics don't ally with Judicial Watch, they have had really great success and they've done a lot of excellent research. But anyway, Judicial Watch was trying to get more documents on Benghazi, surprise, surprise. And they did actually get some interesting documents on Benghazi that totally, confirm that everybody in the White House, including, Hillary and Obama, knew exactly what was going on with these weapons that were, being run by the CIA in Libya and then were, showing up in Syria. But hidden within this FOIA request, and we'll get into why this was even included in this batch of documents, is a 7-page memo, or it's not like an official report, but it was a report from the Defense Intelligence Agency. And in this, it basically lays out that the Pentagon and, the United States government and its allies as well regionally and in the Middle East and also in the West, like, England and whatnot, were totally on board with fostering radical jihadists. Surprise, surprise again. Basically, the main thrust of this is that the anti-Assad coalition, which was mainly composed of Islamist insurgents, was completely supported by, the NATO powers. And, they also predict the establishment of a quote, Islamic state through its union with other terrorist organizations in Iraq and Syria. Now, I'm sure that this doesn't really come as much of a surprise to anybody in the community. We've all been talking about this for quite some time. But it is interesting in that, they were so openly talking about it that this was even released in a FOIA request. And perhaps the most interesting point to all of this is that there was actually like no response whatsoever from the Pentagon. No one, the White House press secretary didn't come out and say, oh, this is, baloney or you're taking it out of context. They sort of just let it hang out there. So I think, we can kind of start with this just because it's an alternative, sort of mainstream article that did get a lot of press and it is opening people up to this idea. But I don't know, James, let's start with you. I mean, what was your sort of take on the Nafiz Ahmed article, any criticisms of it? Perhaps sort of commenting on, why this was not even touched on by the government and why this was even included in this FOIA request.
Well, I actually just saw the Ahmed article today when you sent it to me in preparation for this conversation. I had originally seen this document elsewhere and read it for myself. And I have to say, not only was it not surprising, I think it's not surprising that it hasn't actually become a focus of attention and that there hasn't been much back and forth on it, because it just plays into the entire plausible deniability, which has been the entire sort of MO of the intelligence machinations in Syria since the beginning. Of course, they're not actively working directly with these groups, but these groups might arise, and if they do, well, that's kind of what we want. It's framed in that way that there's an arm's length distance to it, that it's not like there's a smoking gun of, you know, receipts on paychecks to any members of ISIS or anything like that. So again, I think it fits in with that and fits in quite nicely with the all of the other pieces of that puzzle that we've seen through the last couple of years, and that I documented back in episode 295 of my podcast, if people really do want to go back into the deep history of ISIS and its former incarnation as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and the previous Baghdadi, and all of their, you know, multiple deaths and multiple imprisonings and all of the craziness surrounding this story. I think it's just part and parcel of that story. And one other story that stuck out to me just in the last week is from CNN, of course, snag in Pentagon training of Syrian rebels to fight ISIS, where they note that, yes, the same training camps that they were operating in Turkey and Jordan that were discovered to be training fighters that, lo and behold, went on to fight for ISIS. Whoa, who would have thunk it? They're still attempting to do that at the same places, but this program is running into snags. Less than 200 have begun training out of a proposed 6,000 Syrians that they wanted to, that have volunteered for this program and that they want to actively train, but they can't train them fast enough or train enough of them, apparently, because of various logistical problems. It's kind of, I mean, it's so in your face that what they're doing that it's, I mean, you can't even really argue with it. They are just simply 100% backing the people who they know are going to be, that are the terrorists in Syria and Iraq. And they just continue to flagrantly flaunt this in people's face. So it's no surprise to me that this story was picked up in the alt media, and no surprise that it was not picked up on or commented on at all in the mainstream media. But on the note of why this particularly was in that batch of documents relating to Benghazi, that's an interesting question, and one that I hadn't really thought about, so I'd be interested to hear your or Christoph's take on it.
Christoph?
Yes, as James said, there was no smoking gun in the document, but I think it's still very important because it proves that Western governments and media have been lying for years, and that they knew full well that Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups were the driving forces of the insurgency in Syria, and not the so-called moderate Syrian rebels. And I mean, we all know this, but to this day, it is not being acknowledged by Western governments or media. And so I think it was very important that this DIA document came out and that Nafis Ahmed picked it up and highlighted it in his very excellent article. And another important point is that the DIA actually predicted the establishment of a Salafist principality in eastern Syria, what we now know as the Islamic State or ISIS. And the document even states that this is exactly what the supporting powers, in this case the West, Turkey and the Gulf countries, wanted at this point. And ever since ISIS emerged, we have been hearing endless talk in the media stressing that nobody could have seen that coming and that Western intelligence agencies were completely taken by surprise when ISIS crossed the desert and seized cities in Iraq. And it's exactly what they are saying in this DIA document from August 2012. So I think there are a few important points which we can take from the document.
Well, on the note of why this was included in this request, I mean, I just sort of started to wonder. I mean, do they want some segment of the population to completely understand? Yes, this is exactly what we are doing, and maybe to do that, they would sort of include it within. Obviously, I mean, the big story with Judicial Watch's obtaining of these documents was Benghazi. That was the focus. That was what the mainstream and the alternative were picking up on for the most part. And then buried within there is a 7-page document outlining, oh, and by the way, you know, we totally, you know, are helping to create ISIS and this Islamic State. So I don't know if it was maybe somewhat of a controlled release. I mean, I'm not sure what they would get out of it, other than, I mean, maybe just the satisfaction of, you know, having people know, yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We are totally creating this. And, you know, look, we're lying publicly about it, and then we're releasing this and no one even cares. So I don't know, maybe some sort of, you know, sick, you know, satisfaction out of that. Because it is interesting, and it is, again, it, you know, I don't even know why this was in a FOIA request, this would be included.
I don't know what the terms of that request were. Do you know the specific terms?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I do know that, I mean, Judicial Watch has been trying to get emails and whatnot about Benghazi, obviously proving that, you know, Hillary Clinton knew full well what was going on and that this was all a CIA, you know, gun-running program. You know, I guess it is funny that, I mean, it was included, I mean, only in that, you know, they're getting documents on Benghazi. So, you know, the CIA is helping Islamists there funnel guns into Syria to arm the very same, you know, fanatics that were shipping in from Libya over there. Oh, but this is none of this is really happening. So, you know, this sort of sick, I don't know, everything is sort of connected in that sense. And, you know, and it's really funny too. In the Nafees Ahmed article, I think he asks, you know, MI6 and the British government about this, and I think they completely deny it. You know, they're like, no way, there's nothing. You know, nothing in this document is correct. And of course, Christoph, we were just talking the other day about how MI6 had to stop a court case that was investigating someone because it was becoming apparent that they were funding the very same terrorists that the British government was going after. So. Definitely got sort of caught there in one sense. But I mean, moving on a little bit, because, you know, this Nafees Ahmed article is confirmation of something that we've already known. But there's also been some other interesting developments. So obviously we see that, yes, the U.S. is fostering, at the very least, or helping to support ISIS. But there's also Al Qaeda, our other favorite terrorist group, is sort of on the rocks lately. It's not been going so well for them. And Christoph, you actually pointed me to a very interesting article in The Guardian that was they've actually published two. They put a follow up as well. But in them, they quote exclusively two Al Qaeda insiders, Abu Qatada and Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi. Now, both of these men were born in Palestine. They retain Jordanian citizenship as well, and they both live fairly openly in Jordan. Al-Maqdisi was the sort of spiritual leader of al-Zarqawi, who, of course, was sort of the, you know, precursor to what we now know as ISIS. And this was until the Amman hotel bombing in 2005, and Maqdisi, you know, sort of denounced him for that. But Maqdisi was recently in prison and then was released, you know, by the Jordanian government. And it was rumored that he was actually released to counter none other than ISIS, because Maqdisi has sort of come out as being the sort of moderate force. He's also warned about, you know, against jihadis going to fight the Houthis and to stay out of that conflict entirely. And Qatada has also been released from prison in Jordan and is a vocal critic of ISIS. And even at one point, Maqdisi even criticizes 9/11 and says that that was a bad act. So anyway, I thought this was bizarre for a number of reasons. A, that these two, you know, Al-Qaeda figures are just walking around Amman, you know, minding their own business and fielding calls from Spencer Ackerman at The Guardian. But also that they are sort of portraying themselves and shifting the focus into we're the moderate force. ISIS, they're constantly saying, is so extreme, even for us, even for Al-Qaeda, they are completely extreme. You know, they have no goal. They can't really provide services. And this is sort of, you know, opening up for, I don't even know, the sort of moderate wing of Al-Qaeda to kind of come in and save the day, maybe. But Christoph, I mean, you pointed me to this article. So, I mean, what's your take on this? How do you see, you know, what are they trying to get out of this? What might their agenda be exactly? Because it is crazy that we're even, you know, putting moderate and Al Qaeda in the same sentence.
Yes, very interesting that The Guardian published these two articles on the same day a few weeks ago. basically claiming that Al-Qaeda has now been sidelined by ISIS and is in complete disarray. And they cite these two Al-Qaeda experts, their trusted Al-Qaeda sources that they've found in Jordan. And they both claim that our good friend Ayman al-Zawahiri is cut off from his commanders and that Al-Qaeda is rapidly losing ground against ISIS. And other sources cited in the Guardian article tell the same story. They're saying that Al-Qaeda is losing money and recruits to ISIS. Zawahiri is isolated and Al-Qaeda is almost finished. And as I pointed out on Twitter, they are basically telling us here that Zawahiri won't be coming back next season. I guess they don't need him anymore because they have found a new boogeyman and all that's missing is a drone strike or a SEAL Team 6 raid ending Zawahiri's career. So I think the main takeaway from these Guardian articles is that Al-Qaeda is old and in disarray and can't compete with the new jihadi superstars from ISIS, which are now becoming the new boogeyman. Mm. And I guess we'll see more articles making the same point, portraying Al-Qaeda as the more moderate forces or the Taliban in Afghanistan as the more moderate forces and making the case that ISIS is now the new Al-Qaeda. Mm.
James, what are your thoughts on this? What's your sort of interpretation of this, these two moderate Al-Qaeda members?
Yeah, it is bizarre that The Guardian is lovingly quoting these people, these Al-Qaeda members. And it's just interesting to me that, you know, the blank slate of Caliph Ibrahim or Baghdadi or whatever he's going by these days is now being written on with this narrative that he's a protege of Magdisi. And again, I mean, the last time I checked, basically nothing whatsoever is known about Ibrahim or Baghdadi or whatever is he wants to be called, past or background, for sure. I mean, there's just a bunch of kind of bizarre speculation and random things that have appeared online and things. And he may have been a cleric who was in Iraq at such and such a time and that type of
if he
detail.
Even exists.
Yeah, you know? Well, exactly right. I mean, exactly. How much do you trust any part of this story, especially as it's coming through this kind of mainstream reporting mouthpiece that is now reporting Al-Qaeda sources lovingly? I mean, it's. I think the fundamental question we have to ask here is why. I mean, this is happening. It really does seem to be happening that ISIS is ascendant and Al-Qaeda is descending. But why on earth? I mean, we know that Al-Qaeda is Al-Sayyida. We know that it's been fostered, inculcated, helped along from its very inception and continues to be. We know ISIS has been fostered and armed and trained and equipped and made and coddled and into its current structure by the West and its allies, the Gulf states, Turkey. We know that this has been going on for a long time. But why then is this... why is this happening now? Why on earth would they prefer ISIS to Al-Qaeda? And I have come up with four potential answers to this question. Maybe I'm sure there are more, but these are the four ones that strike me. The first is that this is a genuine, actual, real split that's ideologically happening in the jihadi movement, and the backers in the Western countries are just kind of going with the flow with this. All right, so now they want to go this way, so now we'll back them that way. I think that's not very likely, but I guess it is possible that this is just a random or organic event that's happening at the grassroots of the jihadis. This could also be the result of some sort of struggle within the CIA or whatever intelligence networks are helping and fostering and funding this, because there was an interesting part, I believe it was in that Guardian article, talking about how, you know, there's this old guard in the intelligence agency that's fixated on this Al-Qaeda brand, and they can't see, you know, the ISIS threat because they're too caught in the past or whatever. So is there some sort of internal squabble going on with the intelligence agencies that are puppeteering these ones, and there's a faction that wants ISIS and a faction that wants Al-Qaeda? I don't know. It's a possibility. I'm not sure we'd have a way to discern that from the outside, but it's at least something to think about. The third possibility, this is happening because it actually benefits someone who is helping to bring this about. I don't know what group that would be, because I'm trying to think what group would have an actual advantage in the rise of ISIS over the prevailing Al-Qaeda norm. And all that strikes me off the top of my head is maybe Saudi Arabia has something to gain here, because now instead of being the demonizable kind of root of this terror, now they have this arm's length. Oh, it's a, you know, it's a Iraqi group founded by a Jordanian, you know, but they are still doing Saudi Arabia's dirty work, taking care of Shiite Muslims in the eastern oil rich provinces of Saudi Arabia. So there's that. The fourth one is that this is just the next stage of what was a pre-planned program to basically radicalize the jihad movement further and further, and to make it into a more political structure with more political ambitions, because Al-Qaeda, of course, was always more of just an amorphous, it was really just a brand name that was slapped on whatever group anywhere that wanted to have the name. But ISIS really is an organization that has certain political aspirations, so can be used more as kind of a weapon on the chessboard to invade this place or go into that area. As we see, even in Central Asia now, they're trying to worm their way in there and things like that. So is it maybe just sort of part of a longer-term plan that's always been there? And I think those are the four main possibilities I see. I really don't know how to decide between these possibilities. I have my own ideas, but I'd love to hear your guys.
Well, I mean, I viewed these articles and just what's been going on lately, especially this sort of this idea of moderate voices, both within Al-Qaeda and, Christoph, as we've talked about, in the Taliban as well. Again, the Taliban considers ISIS too extreme. You know, this is a pretty extreme group for all intents and purposes. I mean, they just, the other day, attacked Parliament. You know, I mean, they obviously, I don't think we need to really explain how the Taliban is extreme in any of its methods. But yet now we see this group that's emerging with an incredible amount of power, seemingly endless supply of money and arms and fighters. They're taking more and more, not only from Al-Qaeda, but also from the Taliban. And they are, you know, bringing in a new sort of jihadi that is even more extreme again and more radical and more sort of like, tunnel vision, you know. I mean, there's, you know, James, it's interesting. You were saying ISIS does have more of a political structure in the sense that they want to rule whatever certain areas of land. But on another level, I almost see them as less of a political agenda in that, like, you know, Al-Qaeda would at least articulate some sort. They would have something about, say, Palestine or Israel. You know, they would have something to say. So, you know, intellectually speaking, I mean, you don't have to agree with it, but Zawahiri or bin Laden, they were able to articulate a particular idea about, say, Western imperialism. I mean, with ISIS, I see them as just basically like kill, kill, kill. You know, there doesn't have to be a rhyme or reason behind. I mean, they just supposedly banned the playing of backgammon in Mosul for Ramadan. I mean, that's just idiotic, even for a, you know, CIA terror group. So I mean, my sort of takeaway from a lot of this and where I've been sort of going in the direction of is that this really is a bit, ISIS is really about rehabilitating some of our old enemies and perhaps making them seem not only more tolerable, but more necessary. That, you know, I think if Afghanistan is going to be maintain even the semblance of stability, the Taliban needs to be a factor in the government. I think that's just something that is unavoidable at this point, only in that they are a powerful force. And if you want to keep them from attacking the parliament building, they need to be part of the government. Now, if you have this group that's stealing members from them, that's even more extreme, then maybe the Taliban doesn't look quite so bad. And at least, you know, you can use your, you know, realpolitik and be like, well, you know, we need them right now. I mean, you know, at least in the short term. And the same is true, I think, even with Al-Qaeda. We have these moderate, you know, Al-Qaeda members speaking from Jordan. I mean, really, Mogdisi actually seems, you know, pretty, just like a sort of, you know, semi-radical jihadi. He doesn't seem that wild or crazy anymore. So suddenly now he's sort of looks like he could be something. And to just sort of wrap all that up, I was talking the other day with Tom Secker, and we were just sort of tossing around some ideas about, you know, this topic and whatnot. And he pointed out to me, this is eerily similar to the season finale of the CIA's TV show Homeland. And I don't know how many people watch this, but the composite character Dara Dahl, who represents the deep state, the Gladio network, he actually ends up making a deal with a terrorist called Haqqani. And he basically goes on and on about saying how this is important for right now. He's more, you know, he's acceptable as opposed to some of these other people. And we need to make a deal with him now, at least in the short term. Now, I only bring that up because if it's in the show Homeland, the CIA wants you to think think about it. They are implanting that, particularly in this season. And this seems to be going down that same route. I mean, I could see some sort of alliance perhaps between, you know, various disparate Al-Qaeda type groups fighting ISIS. Now, I don't know, but that was sort of the general sort of way I was going. And this, again, might just be in the short term. This could only, you know, for whatever. And I sort of am viewing, I'm wondering if ISIS is more of a placeholder for right now, that they, because they haven't really solidified what they are. I mean, they are this, they're even more disparate and, you know, nebulous than Al-Qaeda is. I mean, they seemingly are everywhere. You know, they're in Libya, now they're in Afghanistan. And again, I mean, who knows what the reality of that really is. But I wonder if maybe they're just sort of a placeholder. But I don't know, Christoph, I mean, what's your take on this?
Yes, as you said, they are also becoming a branch, just like Al-Qaeda. They have new chapters which are setting up in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Yemen, and now also in Russia, where they have actually eclipsed the Caucasus Emirate as the most dominant terrorist organization, which is a very interesting development, which you can get into. And of course, what is happening in Afghanistan is really, really interesting for a number of reasons. Because we have now the Taliban as the more moderate force. And just recently, the number two leader, the deputy leader of the Taliban, Mansour, sent a letter to ISIS leader Baghdadi, basically telling him to stay out of Afghanistan. And he warned Baghdadi against dividing the jihadists in other countries into two camps, what they have been doing recently, for example, in Syria and in Afghanistan. Ever since ISIS emerged in Afghanistan, the Taliban and ISIS have been fighting against each other. And in recent weeks, the clashes escalated, especially in the eastern province of Nangarhar. So this letter from the Taliban is probably one last attempt to settle the differences before the conflict between the two groups turns into an all-out war. And this is very interesting for a number of reasons. For one, it undermines the Afghan peace talks, which had actually seen some progress due to China's efforts. Because even if the Taliban agree to strike a deal with Kabul, ISIS and other groups will keep fighting. And of course, there's also the possibility that the violence could spill across the border into Central Asia or even China. And the Taliban don't have any interest in expanding their activities across the border, but it doesn't apply to other groups such as ISIS or, for example, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. And in this context, it was particularly interesting to see that former Afghan President Hamid Karzai recently pointed out in an interview with Russia Today that ISIS expansion into Afghanistan would not be possible without a foreign hand. And he said, if you ever hear in the coming days or months or years that ISIS is on the rise in Afghanistan and is strong and expanding militarily, it will mean that it's a foreign-backed force intending to destabilize the region, particularly Central Asia, China, and Russia. And that is, of course, what Russian, Chinese, and Central Asian officials have been saying for the past couple of months, and what's often dismissed in Western media as a conspiracy theory. So there are a number of different reasons why some forces could be interested in supporting the rise in Afghanistan or in other countries, for example, in Russia. In Afghanistan, reasons are, for example, to sabotage the Afghan peace process, to destabilize the region, or to present the Taliban as the moderates who will get a new place in the government.
Hmm. Yeah, James, any comments on that or on some of the stuff I had said earlier as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to pick up on there. And I think it is interesting to look at Afghanistan specifically and what is taking place and what could take place there, especially as we move into this era where Afghanistan is still very much on the table now, as supposedly, you know, the U.S. is trying to withdraw, blah, blah, blah. It is interesting, and it strikes me that if we take it from the perspective of, let's imagine we are controllers of these jihadi organizations behind the scenes, we are the shadowy members of some secret intelligence agency that's puppeteering all of this. If our goal is simply to foment chaos in order to keep the situation chaotic and keep all of the players at the table and make it a security situation that requires, you know, military presence, if that is the goal, then that's remarkably easy to do, and exactly with a group like ISIS that just set them loose. They're the dogs of war, and they'll just, you know, they'll go crazy, and they'll, you know, everyone's afraid of them, and they'll go do anything. And to create that type of boogeyman is I mean, it's obviously just destabilizing, and I think that's the word we've used a lot. And I guess we could see that as being part of a strategy, you know, an anti-Assad strategy, but it does seem that it's much larger than that at this point, and it's obviously being aided from the outside, and I think a lot of people maybe have something, some reason for just fomenting chaos in various parts of this, the geo... location here, and and again, I think it's extremely easy to do that. I mean, all you have to do is send in 50,000 Uyghurs with Turkish passports, right, guys?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I do wonder though sometimes with the destabilization that at some point they have to stabilize. I mean, you can't just. I mean, maybe not. Maybe they're totally fine with that. But for me, at least, I do see Afghanistan as being not like Iraq, where it's fine to have Iraq in shambles, you know, because that's obviously Iran is right there. I mean, obviously Iran and Afghanistan share a border as well. But, you know, part of me still thinks that Afghanistan is too important for it to be completely destabilized at the level it is right now, where, I mean, the government in Kabul controls Kabul. That's about it. They have no power, especially in the north, but also in the south as well, in other regions. And there's too much money to be made, say, on heroin alone, for this to be completely destabilized and to have the Taliban running amok everywhere, and now to have ISIS. So I don't know. I still wonder if there isn't, you know, if they don't want to pacify this at some point, and perhaps that is with having the Taliban step in, and, you know, perhaps, you know, the Pakistanis will sort of, you know, pull the strings and kind of tell them, you've got to shape up right now, guys. You know, we can maybe make a deal for you to be in some sort of power sharing thing, but, you know, ISIS is, we've got to get rid of that, you know, straight away. And this is sort of, you know, not directly related at all, but I just sort of found it interesting. Again, we're, you know, talking about the sort of the end of Al-Qaeda, perhaps, or Al-Qaeda turning into the, you know, moderate, you know, peaceful force. And as this is going on right now, I mean, it seems entirely likely that Mohamed Morsi is going to be executed. No one seems to be coming to save this guy. And, I mean, we're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood and, you know, the most powerful branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And this has a lot of roots, you know, go back not only to British intelligence and the CIA, but I mean, to a lot of the sort of early Al-Qaeda founders. And we're seeing Mohamed Morsi probably being executed. So again, I mean, there is a distinct shift that's going on. And I'm not sure where exactly that's going or to what, you know, degree this is going to be happening. But again, it is interesting. I mean, I don't know. What is... How do you guys feel right now about, I mean, within Syria? I mean, we were just talking a lot about Afghanistan and what might be going on there. It does seem right now that the war in Syria is sort of turning sour again. And I mean, what, Christoph, for instance, like, what do you see ISIS, how are they going to be playing a role in whatever is happening in Syria right now? Obviously, they're the dominant force. But again, ISIS is not like Hamas or the Taliban. They're not going to be able to rule Syria. What's the next step for that?
That's a very good question. I saw just last week ISIS beheaded one of the senior leaders of the Al-Nusra Front in Raqqa, and they released also a new propaganda video featuring an Uzbek fighter who called on other jihadists to defect from the Al-Nusra Front and join ISIS. So they are playing the same script which we've seen in other countries. They're trying to sideline the other groups, in this case the Al-Nusra Front, and they are doing this by showcasing their extreme brutality most of the time. They're beheading people left and right, and this offers Western media the opportunity to portray the Al-Nusra Front and other groups as the more moderate forces. In recent months, we've seen a real push by some factions of the media to portray the Al-Nusra Front as the new moderate group which can be supported by the West against Assad. With regard to ISIS and what their purpose is, that's a good question. They are most of the time ruling the parts of the country where they can, where they don't have much resistance. So if, for example, the Syrian government launches an offensive in some part of the country, in eastern Syria, they vanish and they turn up again in another part of Iraq, for example. So it's very difficult. They don't really hold their positions except for example, in Raqqa or Mosul. And they they choose their points where they are staying. So it's difficult to to say what their actual plan is and what their purpose is in Syria. I don't really know. Perhaps they're really planning to establish this Salafist principality in the long term, which means the Sunni state in eastern Syria and in western Iraq, as envisioned in the Yenon plan. So that there is the connection between Syria and Shia Iraq and Shia Iran is cut. That's perhaps the purpose of ISIS in the long term, but at the moment I don't see it. Mm.
James, any thoughts?
Again, it is difficult to know what the actual plan is here, but it is important to point out once again, and again, I know that most of the audience will already be aware of this in the general sense, but it is important to understand just how all of their major operations, all of ISIS's major victories in Syria and Iraq, have been facilitated by, if not the active cooperation, although probably the active cooperation, at least the passive acceptance of the West. And that's not even controversial. Bloomberg was reporting last month that when ISIS retook Ramadi, the U.S. watched Islamic State fighters, vehicles, and heavy equipment gather on the outskirts and then retake the city. And they actively did not even attempt to stop it. This latest takeover of Palmyra, ISIS says, we're going to take over, you know, historic sites in the country. They gather a convoy of 1,800 troops and then, you know, make the march over to Palmyra, and oh, suddenly they're there taking it over. Wow. You know, who would have thought it? And I just thought, there is a very nice comment on Twitter from a Syrian girl who noted that now they're setting landmines and explosives around Palmyra and threatening to blow it up if they're attacked. And Syrian girl notes, you know what would have been very helpful in that case? Gas. But anyway, at any rate, yeah, so all of this really is being allowed to happen, and it could end, obviously, at the flip of a switch if it was wanted, if they wanted it to end. So I don't see any point to this at this moment, certainly in the Syria-Iraq situation, other than destabilization. That's all this is. And as you say, there's no sense in which they're going to take over the running of Syria or Iraq. They've just carved out their little niche with, you know, mostly unpopulated areas that they can scramble away from, as Christoph points out. So I don't think there is a real agenda here other than the destabilization that we see that it's causing. And I guess the potential, as always, for further involvement in the region. I mean, that's the only thing that I keep coming back to.
Yeah. Well, I was just sort of thinking in my head, too. I mean, if al-Nusra is also moderate, and al-Qaeda is moderate, I mean, then we're going to have this sort of complete, I mean, proxy war where essentially the deep state Gladio is just, you know, pitting one group of operatives against another group of operatives. And I mean, maybe that has been one of the goals all along. I mean, they no longer even need to use, Western troops or military contractors. I mean, now we can just have one controlled terror gang attacking another controlled terror gang. And at, you know, as you said, James, at the drop of a hat, we can make this end. I mean, obviously, I mean, we know exactly where ISIS is at all times. And as you were saying, they announced they're going to go somewhere. And, you know, while Obama is talking about, oh, we just, you know, killed such and such a member and, you know, 20,000 ISIS fighters killed in a drone strike, they're walking into an ancient city in Syria and, you know, filling it with landmines everywhere. So, again, it is difficult in geopolitics and sort of murky world of jihadis and espionage to kind of figure out something. But I do think there is a serious shift that's going on just within the past few months, as we've been laying out here, not only the again, very public admission that, the West is creating ISIS, but again, these moderate al-Qaeda forces coming out, Mohamed Morsi about to be executed, the Taliban, sort of struggling as well. So I'm sure we're going to be kind of returning to this again and again. Any quick thoughts from either of you guys? I think we'll sort of wrap it up here.
Before we wrap it up, I would just love to get your and Christoph's take on the Central Asian sort of issues here and China and how that plays into it, because it certainly does seem China is at least theoretically targeted by this, and they seem genuinely against what's happening with ISIS here. It does seem very much what we would expect from a Gladio B operation, but I'd just like to hear any further thoughts you have on that aspect of this.
Christoph.
Yes, the situation in northern Afghanistan has been getting worse and worse each day. It's really, the Taliban have. I just remember yesterday seeing on Twitter that people in the region in Kunduz, which has long been held by the international forces, they were saying that Kunduz is about to fall. It's the fifth largest city in Afghanistan. It's on the verge of collapse. The Taliban are about to take it. The governor of Kunduz was seen yesterday at the airport where he was about to leave for Kabul. So the situation in northern Afghanistan is pretty bad, to say the least. And China has been doing a lot of recent months to restart the stalled Afghan peace talks. So they put a lot of pressure on Islamabad, on Pakistan, to bring the Taliban to the negotiation table. And there have been a number of secret meetings, many of them in China, in Xinjiang, for example, recently, where they are meeting with representatives of the Kabul government to get to some kind of deal. But this is, of course, complicated by the fact that some factions of the Taliban don't want to deal, want to keep fighting because they're winning. And now you have another actor with ISIS. So the Chinese are very worried that the violence could spill over because they share a border with Afghanistan in Badakhshan province. And Badakhshan province has seen a lot of fighting in recent months, and the Taliban have been gaining some ground. They took one district a few weeks ago, and the Afghan government said a few days ago that they recaptured it, but it's not exactly clear if they can be believed, because they said a week earlier that they had already captured the district. And it's complete chaos in northern Afghanistan, and all surrounding countries, especially Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, are also already seeing problems on their borders. Turkmenistan last year invaded Afghanistan, sent a few troops across the border to set up fences and to drive back the insurgent forces which had settled on the border. And Tajikistan is building a new base on the border, and Russia is stepping up its support. So I think we are going to hear a lot more about Afghanistan, especially northern Afghanistan, in the near future.
Mm. And I mean, I think also, you know, important to note the everyone is hyping this also to a degree. I mean, the Russians are certainly hyping this at every moment. Tajikistan has been hyping this like it's gone out of style. And obviously, I mean, they are scared. Particularly Tajikistan is just economically, it's the poorest Central Asian nation. It militarily, it's extremely weak. I mean, it basically serves no other purpose than being a NATO transshipment point for heroin. So there's not a lot that Tajikistan can do. But all that being said, it is a very worrying situation with militants there. And again, it doesn't have to be – you don't need something huge. You know, you can have a few – you know, they keep – you know, like Russia and the CSTO, they keep training with particularly with Tajikistan, and they're running these military exercises with, what was it, Christoph? You know, it's like 700
strong Taliban invasion of Tajikistan. They were practicing for that recently. Yeah, it's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's just like, right. I mean, the Taliban's not going to march in brigades, you know, waving the black flag or whatever. That's just not going to happen. But, you know, you could start seeing more. I mean, we just saw this Tajik police commander, defecting, so you know, supposedly to ISIS, of course, trained in the United States, both by the Pentagon and Blackwater. And, I mean, expressed no previous adherence to ISIS or radical jihadists or anything like that. And now suddenly he's the new poster child for ISIS. And he has talked a lot about bringing the fight back to Tajikistan, back to Russia. So that's extremely worrying, I think. And especially, again, I mean, Tajikistan in particular, Rahman, the leader, is a bit of a psycho and views anything as an extreme act. Some dissident in Turkey, talking to a friend of, you know, that's a huge deal for him. You know, he'll try and send someone and kill him. So a Tajik military commander trained by the United States talking about coming back there, that is very worrying to them. So they are, you know, reacting very strongly. And just quickly, on some of the stuff with China, I think China is suddenly, trying to scrambling to figure out what to do because, again, Badakhshan province does share a very small border with China. It's just over in Xinjiang. It could be conceivable that we could start seeing that. And again, I mean, the Uyghur situation in Xinjiang has been, you know, keeps getting stirred. You know, Christoph, on our show, we've talked many, many times. You know, every few months, there's like a new either this smuggling ring that was, you know, shipping Uyghurs into Turkey and eventually into Syria. We had that report about the American teacher who was recruiting possibly Uyghur students at a university to go fight in Syria. So that's scary. And just quickly, China is, I believe, is already finalized a bill that would, for the first time ever, allow them to send foreign troops overseas to other countries. So that's a huge step, and that's something that is pretty, you know, that is very not Chinese at all in terms of their foreign policy. I mean, they have specifically stayed out of any conflict. I mean, they don't send troops anywhere. So for them to, you know, we're not talking about peacekeepers at the UN, for them to sign a bill that would allow them to have special forces running around Afghanistan, Central Asia, I mean, anywhere really. I mean, once you open up the door for, you know, sending troops, I mean, you could send them anywhere. They could send them to Russia, they could send them Turkey, whatever. So that's a huge step. And again, that's something that's really important. And again, I think, is there a degree that China is panicking? Yeah. But on the other, you know, the other hand, I think they're also, they're able to read the tea leaves. And just quickly before, you know, I was just reading this morning on Kama, which is an Afghan news site, a NATO official basically saying, don't worry, ISIS doesn't pose any threat whatsoever. The Taliban is not even all that, you know, to write home about. But there's really nothing. There's nothing going on. Everything is hunky dory. You know, don't look over here. You know, go worry about whatever Kim Kardashian or something like that. So, you know, they're downplaying this as much as they're, you know, other groups are overplaying this. But yeah, I don't know. Any other quick things there?
I think we've covered all the questions. I'm not sure we've provided all the answers, but
no.
It's not really possible to do that from our vantage point. And I think at any rate, we need to be aware of the various possibilities for this group and how it could be used, because I think that's going to really influence what's happening in the region and how we can hopefully prevent people from falling for another trick of some sort on the geopolitical stage. Well, good luck with that. Maybe that's asking for a bit much, but at any rate, we can be at least more aware of where this is likely to head. And I think Afghanistan and the security situation there is the next sort of shoe to drop, as you guys have been talking about. So I hope people are listening to New Great Game. I hope my listeners are listening to New Great Game Roundup and the Great Game Roundup that Christoph does at Boiling Frogs as well. Very important to keep an eye on that situation. And I know you guys are doing an excellent job doing it. So my hat's off to you for that.
Oh, well, thank you, James. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. Again, if you're interested in any of this and you want to hear some more, me and Christoph do our own podcast every month called Porkin's Great Game, where we deal with all of these sort of topics. And we just recently were talking about a lot of these different things. And of course, you can find Christoph's work at christophgehrman.blogspot.com, as well as here on boilingfrogspost.com. And you can find all of James's work at corbettreport.com. And I know I've never really said this before on the BFP Roundtable, but if you're interested in any of the other work that I do a bunch of other podcasts, you can go to porkinspolicyreview.com, and I hope you do, and check out some of the work. And of course, please do let us know how you felt about this episode. Let us know your comments, if you have any disagreements, if you have any arguments, something that you'd like us to maybe talk about in a future episode, anything like that. Definitely leave them in the comments section. We'll all try and respond as much as we can to all of those. And I know that the comment sections are always very interesting at BFP. And again, you know, please do spread the word, tell people about us, get more, you know, we need more subscribers all the time. And we absolutely love doing this work. So thank you all so much for tuning in, and we'll be talking to you very soon.